The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
What say you, Richard Pellet Murdoch, are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have to evacuate the building.
Beautiful courthouse, set the scene here. There's a back door that I really wanted to go out of, but it's locked. And it goes out onto this portico, I guess I'd call it. It's the front part of the courthouse. And I understand that when you graduate from high school here, you often go on those steps to take the high school picture. But it was locked. Well, it was unlocked for this because to get everyone out, you needed more exit. To be available, so we were able to walk out calmly through those wonderful front steps there and go out, and it swept through pretty quickly that it was a bomb scare, that people knew that.
Yeah, we heard that from the defense team, actually. Mm-hmm. That's how we got word, and we put it out there right away. Mm-hmm. Tara, actually, our reporter, who I was reporting with at that moment, she got on immediately and let everybody know that she had heard from the defense team that it was indeed a bomb scare. I think it was the first time we'd heard that.
Breaking news there. And so we then had this...
Unbelievable.
Very unfortunate in a lot of ways, though, because not the first time, but this was a day where things were rolling. Mm-hmm. It was very organized, and witnesses were testifying. A lot of information was presented to the jury in the couple hours we had of testimony. So big break in that. And what was it like? And Judge Newman did say, we'll take our lunch break as well.
Right.
Which is appropriate.
So it was about 2 hours.
Two hours.
It was maybe a little bit over 2 hours.
Not too bad. Now, one thing I would say, just to launch into this, if you don't mind, I've been with these jurors because the rumor was sort of swirling around, is this going to intimidate the jurors or is this going to be a problem here? I will say I've been with them from day one. When we came back, very calm, very deliberate. And I'm really confident that these folks, if there was an effort to intimidate anyone, it will not work. They seem to be right back on task. And I was very pleased with their demeanor.
I totally agree with you. And one thing that was running through my mind, and we'll see how this goes in the future, but we had two big school groups there. We had a group of journalism students from USC.
Right.
And we also had, hopefully they're listening tonight. I hope we have you chiming in. You can always look at our Facebook Live, our Twitter, and our YouTube. If you have any questions, TikTok, if you have any questions, pop up. We'll try and get them answered if we can in a timely fashion. But so we had these young kids, and then we had a whole another school group from like a high school nearby, because Becky Hill's amazing at bringing in these kids so that they can see this historical trial that's taking place, not just because it's a Murdoch that's on trial, but because of the legal ramifications of a case like this and how it could affect our legal system for years.
Yeah, and I thought it was really neat,
forward.
Too. Yeah, they're journalism students, right? And I thought that was really great that they were there to see the... Cover the coverage, right? Because it's something. The coverage is intense here.
Yeah, so that happened, which was unfortunate that happened. But now we're going to listen to a little bit about the testimony that was going on. Did you want to say anything about what happened there? Or are you good? And Max, I do hear something in the background right now. I'm not quite sure what that is.
I don't hear anything.
It's not a bomb threat, is it?
No, I don't think so.
It's not coming through for me. I don't know about you, Charlie.
Speaking, no, mine's fine.
Someone's talking in the background.
Anyway.
But if you don't hear it, let's go and move forward into what happened with Annette Griswold. She takes this stand today. The jury gets to hear from her. She is filling in the holes of CFO Jeannie Seckinger. What happened with her testimony? Let's roll tape.
I love to resist. Like,
there's something on this. Oh, sorry. Technical difficulties. That's okay. It's day 13 of this trial, and you guys, it's been a day 13 if I've ever seen one in my life. Right. Drew, talk to us a little bit about Annette Griswold.
I thought she was, again, another powerful witness for the state, just because of how prepared she seemed and how confident she seemed, unflappable, unfazed, would be some things I would use to describe her up there on the stand. She had her stuff together. She knew her days and dates and what was going on. Yes. And she came through as very credible, I think, in the process. Again, we joked between ourselves just a little bit about this before we went live. It was another instance of some candor, shall we say, from one of the people testifying for the state, in that she got up there and said she was describing, and I thought this was incredibly telling, describing the differences in Alex's personality before the boat crash, after the boat crash, and after the murders. And one of the more telling things was she said he, quote, had his butt on his shoulders after that boat crash. She didn't use butt. She used a little bit more colorful language, synonym for a donkey, shall we say. But it was again, as we're trying to prove the state of mind, the tell the whole story, the res gestae, and get to that extraordinary theory of motive for the state, I thought it was more than valuable hearing what she had to say and her interpretations of Alec and the way he was before and after.
I agree.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think we're ready to play this clip now. Before we play it, I just want to set it up. You know, we've heard from Annette Griswold. She's filling in the holes of what CFO Jeannie Seckinger said the day before. Basically, that they were very suspicious, that something was wrong. Jeannie had gone on June 7th, the afternoon of this double murder of Alec and Maggie, or, you know, around that time. And hours later, you know, there's this horrible, horrific murder takes place.
Right.
This is how we hear Annette said the reaction was to the murders.
We were like, please lock our doors. You know, we're scared. Who is this aimed at? Is it a client retaliating? Is it, you know, aimed at Alec? Is it aimed at the firm? We didn't know. We just had so many questions, no answers, a million thoughts running through our heads. We were just there, you know, supporting each other and helping one another through this grieving process. And at the same time, we were very protective over Alec and Randy. We wouldn't let them leave the office if strange cars were driving around. We would say, don't walk out yet. There's a white car that's went around three times. I mean, we were in complete mama bear mode.
So this is right after the murders. Everybody's terrified. They're horrified at what's happened to Maggie and Paul. This is a very small community. They're all close friends. We've heard about the brotherhood of the law firm. We've seen it. We've heard so much testimony already. This is just another layer. Now we're really hearing how it's like trickled down into all parts of Alec's life. Nobody's talking about financial allegations of misdeeds, right?
No. And just from a legal standpoint, too, I was really very interested in her testimony, because to paint the scene here a bit as well, she, of course, is his longtime paralegal, and she handled the more serious cases for Alec. And my firm handles similar type cases, and I was just, and boy, I mean, the paralegal is so valuable. But when she went through, I was just impressed with her expertise. Oh, we handle premise liability, workers' comp, Med-Mal, and we do it this way. And she just came across as somebody who's very, very competent professional. And struck me as, you know, she had just what I would call real leadership qualities. You weren't going to, she was going to handle her role appropriately in the law firm and needed the income. She talked about her, I guess her husband died of a heart attack, single mom. Yeah, that was very compelling. But as she described her relationship with Alec, I really thought that she connected so well with the jurors, and she did such a great job of tying together so many loose ends. And she's the one that really, don't you think, started the whole situation. Yeah. She reported her concerns to the CFO and was strong enough to do that, and mm-hmm. went through, and she caught these little minor details. For example, the forged check writing, it's mm-hmm. a very good name, isn't it? Forgery check writing, really, is what
you
it,
can't
what
forget it.
Was.
It. Yep.
And so she noticed that was being done when she was not at the office. Mm-hmm. What's the big rush? And not to get into the weeds here too much, but she explained why it wasn't necessary to rush through these things. But in one case, it's the workers' compensation lien, and not to bore the listeners too much with this, but you can't settle what's called a third-party case until the workers' compensation matter is handled, because they have an interest in the third party. You can't disperse. And she said, what's the rush on dispersing? So when I'm hearing her say all these things, this lady's really in the middle of knowing what's going on. Mm-hmm. And her antenna were up, that it was a very, I thought, telling moment for me that she, in the fact that, I'm sure it wasn't easy for her, right? I mean, for her to be there, that she I know, but it, you, to your point too, she did describe how this kind of dual personality of Alec, we've heard quite a bit here, right? The language you use, they also talked about him being a Tasmanian devil late in the afternoon sometimes and being in a flurry. So I was just really impressed with her, and that word she used, fluttered, on the back end of that.
We should talk about that because it
was great. Yeah,
but to expound on that a little bit, I mean, I do think that Alec was, the chaos that he caused was sounding more and more purposeful in the testimony that we've heard, that the chaos was part of the plan. The less people understood, it's just, once again, the shell game of you don't know what's under what. And the more he kept people in the dark, the easier it would be to carry through with these alleged crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, I'll be honest, looking back at the Russell Lafitte federal trial, that was the whole premise of Russell Lafitte's defense. Alec Murdoch was a master mm-hmm. manipulator, to quote his defense attorney, Lafitte's defense attorney, Bart Daniel. He was a world-class con man. Mm-hmm. And someone attested to this yesterday. I don't know if it was Sechinger or Crosby or somebody, or it might have been Annette Griswold today. I don't know. I'm having trouble pinpointing exactly mm-hmm. who said it, but they said essentially, looking back, they have trouble believing that some of his absent-mindedness and things of that nature weren't purposeful. Mm-hmm. He could con you. He could talk you into believing him very easily. And they even attested that was part of his, right? That was part of his success as an attorney. It wasn't that he had so much technical skill. He was a great reader.
Gift of gab.
Yeah. He could work you into doing what he wanted you to do, and make it sounds like he was the type of guy that could make you think it was your idea all along.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's kind of guy that you just want to please, probably too, mm-hmm. to some degree. Mm-hmm. Max, tell me, do you have something for us here?
Yeah, somebody asked, do we know what he spent the money on?
Great
question.
Do we know what he spent the money on in terms of all of this money, these millions of dollars, right?
By and large, a lot of it went to pay off his personal debts. He was constantly, and this is going to come out, I think, further throughout the trial, as soon as tomorrow, I think, we're probably going to hear from somebody from Palmetto State Bank talking about the just astounding overdrafts and
credit card balances
that he was carrying. He was in no sooner than money was coming in, was it going out, and his accounts were constantly in the red. The question, I think a better question is, what wasn't he spending the money on? And that's still one we probably don't have a full picture of. What wasn't he spending the money on? But the big ones were debt, his own personal mm-hmm. debt, and he eventually resorted to stealing from his own clients to pay back those debts.
So you feel comfortable that there's no missing money here? You think that there's enough going out that it accounts for...
He
also had a very good income, correct? As a plaintiff's attorney, on top of the money he stole.
I'm not that confident to say that specifically that there's no missing money. I think there probably is some that's unaccounted for. And we even heard last week in the in-camera hearings with the SLED forensic accounts examiner who looked at all of Murdoch's income and expenditures. He was saying he eventually had to stop himself or else he'd have been there forever trying to track that. You can track a dollar forever is basically what he said. And he put limits on himself, like one level of expenditure out from the accounts to see where it was going. Just to, for his own sanity and for the sake of time in tracking it. I think with the, a proper amount of time and a broader workforce, SLED could probably tell us down to the penny where some of that money was going, but we have a major general idea of where some of the more nefarious expenditures are going.
And that is to be continued, right? Like we got more on that one. Right. I want to, so there was a turning point, as again, another turning point as far as what Griswold was talking about today. And this kind of leads into what we think will be testimony by Friday on his relationships and where this money was going and how he was spending some of the money, more nefarious ways he was spending it. Annette Griswold, let's listen to what she says. This is September. She's missing fees from a specific account. We don't really have to, we can't go into it, but a specific account. He said over and over again to him, no, I never got that money. That money doesn't exist. I haven't gotten that money. This is tens of thousands of dollars. This isn't just like
$792,000.
There you go. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. So there's a lot of money. And here's what Annette Griswold discovers when she goes into his office to just pick up a couple of files.
A check kind of floated like a feather to the ground. And when I bent over to pick it up, I saw the check and what it said and had on it, and I instantly became very upset because it happened to be one of the checks from the Ferris case that didn't exist.
And what did you see on the check that let you know that stuck out in your mind?
It was from Chris Wilson's office. It was written to Richard Alexander Murdoch, and at the bottom it said Ferris fees. And it was dated March.
So what did you realize at that point?
I said, he's been lying this whole time.
What an unbelievable shock.
To my earlier point here, you get this paralegal that she knew enough not to, you know, the third, not again, not to get too technical, but you get the workers' comp settlement. You can't settle the third party, meaning the money coming that's not covered by workers' comp, until you get approval through the workers' comp system to settle that, because they've got a claim on that money. So here you got another just astute paralegal, check fluttering, and the happenstance. It reminded me of the Forrest Gump movie, right, where they see that feather floating and how life gets affected by random events. Well, here this random event where she finds this check. And so what then happens? We now know that after this, that this chain of events starts occurring, and then we'll hear more about this, I believe, later on with Witness Wilson, right, where he gets confronted a couple of days later. And then we have the botched assisted suicide right after this. And so I think this fluttering, wouldn't you say, caused these other events?
Well, it was right then. I mean, as soon as that happened, they were able to... It turned out Jeannie Seckinger was running numbers, wasn't she?
Yeah, it happened at the same time. And I think, again, this is really strong to the state's theory of motive, and that his world was crumbling around him. And the bill was coming due, so to speak, on his deceit and his thefts. And he knew... You mentioned something a moment ago, Charlie, about a part of her testimony where she said, essentially, some of this peculiar stuff started happening when she wasn't in the office, specifically after she had questioned him a few times early on about, this isn't how this is supposed to work.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you sure? And I think one of the more powerful things that we ended up hearing from Annette was she's confident. She's good at her job. She knows something's not right, and yet when it was time to speak up and stand up, she had this immense fear. Again, to the point you made, she's a single mom. Her husband's, she's very dependent on this income, and she has to make a choice. Do I go and raise concerns and potentially lose my career. Like her daughter even told her, "It's like, Mom, get your resume ready.
Right.
If you're gonna go and pursue this, get your resume ready." And she said, "You know what? No." And she bravery for sure. She went and she did the right thing, and it ended up. I think Creighton Waters made this very astute point. Wasn't Annette Griswold that got fired? It's Alec Murdoch.
Yes,
yeah. And it's.
Well, and it happened so quickly, and it was a chain of events afterwards that was just, there was no stopping mm-hmm. the train at that point, right? Mm-hmm. So you have this moment where Griswold discovers this check that actually is the money that they've been looking for, and he has adamantly said he didn't have. You have Seckinger all of a sudden running these reports, and it's just obvious there's a problem. They get to the law partners. We know that part of the story. We know that Randy Murdoch, his brother, has to be told, look, it looks like Alec's been stealing money from the firm. Alec's forced to resign, and to be continued is
yes.
where we're going to go, because we've got a lot to uncover over the next couple of days. We do hear from sources that we have that Eddie Smith is going to be coming to testify. And Eddie Smith, of course, cousin Eddie, the defense says he's his longtime drug dealer. We've heard testimony in, I've been how many times up to court in Columbia to hear what's going on with Eddie Smith and all kinds of charges that are going to be coming down that are involved with drugs. So there's a lot of reason to think that we're going to have a lot more testimony coming this week about what happened in that assisted botched suicide attempt.
Yes. Yes.
Charlie, what did you think of, we'll go into legal strategy mode here for a minute. What did you think of Jim Griffin's play, ploy has a negative connotation, I think. I'm not trying to mm-hmm. be negative. But Jim Griffin's play to say, hey, Your Honor, all right, if we're gonna read this letter and we're gonna give context on this letter, for backstory,
this letter,
Alec sent a letter to Annette Griswold from drug rehab,
a text,
and it was also, I think, addressed to his other paralegal. And when Creighton Waters for the state introduced it, he mentioned that it was sent while Alec was in rehab, and coming back after a short break, Jim Griffin's like, hey, we're about to cross the bridge of no return here. If we start mentioning the drug rehab, I don't think we should mention it, Your Honor. In fact, I think we should not only not mention the drug rehab, I think we should go back and strike every bit of this financial information that you've already allowed so far. And Judge Newman didn't do that. And then what happens next? Creighton Waters doesn't say anything about too much about the drug rehab or anything like that. But Jim Griffin, the person who just lobbied not to even have it allowed, Jim Griffin comes in and reads the whole letter and goes deep into it. I thought it was amazing just to watch that. Let me tell you what's going on there,
because I was fascinated by that back and forth, because I prosecute a lot of cases. Firm now handles criminal defense. So here's the horns of the dilemma that Attorney Griffin, I thought he handled it well. Where we are in the trial, the judge has admitted all the financial information to prove motive. And so in the text message, we have a new issue here. It's drug usage at a rehab.
Alec Murdoch in rehab.
Yeah, which could.
The whole story.
Yeah, and so Jim stood up, Attorney Griffin stood up and said, Your Honor, just subject to our usual objections. And then the judge looked, said, I haven't seen it. So let me talk. So he read it. He says, well, there's a new issue here. You've got drug usage, which can go to character. Do you want this admitted without objection, subject to your only other objection? That's when he then got into this, well, we want you to strike everything, no denied. So then Judge Newman, I thought, handled it brilliantly, is, well, it's coming in, but I'll take out the drug usage if you want me to. Then Jim conferred with Dick, Attorney Harpootlian, and the others on how do I handle this. And the upshot of it all, let's let it all in, right? Let's let it go.
Here we go.
And so now we have the drug issue in the trial now, which mm-hmm. was not referenced in opening statement, right? But publicly, before the trial, correct me if I'm wrong, because y'all have more intimate knowledge than I do, that was all I heard, was all this money was mm-hmm. spent on drug usage, used in rehab.
They had used it as their crutch for a lot of the
pre-trial.
The bad acts, right?
Yeah, right now,
or all the things that they were talking about was this drug usage. We don't know why it was all the... I don't know.
Okay.
And once again, we're getting to a place where we have to wait to see where the next piece of the puzzle comes. Max, did you have something else for us before we wrap this up?
People have been asking about, you know, Paul's friends have been testifying, but we haven't seen anything about Maggie's friends or family. No one's been there about Maggie.
Wow, that's a great question.
People are just wondering, like, are they there?
Question.
Are they going to testify? Anything like that?
Yeah, I'll take this one, and maybe I pardon the personal, but I've been involved with lots of murder prosecutions, mm-hmm. right? And I must say, I don't know if I've ever been involved with a case where the blood family of the murder victim, one of them, hasn't been in attendance. Mm. So there's got to be something going on there. And I suspect maybe it's the intense media pressure and attention on this.
Yeah.
They know
all eyes would be on mm-hmm. them. And we're talking about Maggie's parents primarily. Mm-hmm. We've seen... Buster, we've seen his girlfriend. We've got Lynn Murdoch, who's been coming every day. That's Alex's sister. John Marvin has been in attendance the whole time. His wife's been in attendance for the most part, and so has Randy on several days. Not every day,
days. I'll mention this, too. And this is, to me, also really, I mean, this trial has everything, right? But when I ran for Attorney General, one of my big issues was the Victims' Bill of Rights. It's in the state constitution, and it's now been funded by the General Assembly. So in every case, in this criminal case of South Carolina with a victim, you get a victim advocate.
Mm-hmm. I met her today.
Yes, Ms. Allen, right?
Yeah.
So if you step back from this, you've got the defendant's family also being in the victim category, right?
Right.
So she's got this... very challenging task, which mm-hmm. I think she's handling really well, the victim advocate. And, of course, he's being accused, the dad being accused of Buster, of course, of murder.
Right.
Right? And so here we are. There's kind of a dual role going on here because her office is prosecuting the victim's father, if you're catching all this. So there's just so much going on in this case. I must say, I don't know if I've ever been involved with anything that has so many layers of complexity, both factually and legally, and really historically and probably culturally as well.
Yeah, and it's changing. It's changing every day. And that's why, I mean, you guys hear us say things that we're like, wait a minute, we just took a left turn. We took a right turn. Mm-hmm. That's going to happen because, honestly, I think the prosecution and defense both have to act. They're also dealing with some moves right now on mm-hmm. offense as they get through this, like what just happened to Griffin.
Oh, yeah, we had a glitch. We don't have enough time to talk about it. There's a technical glitch on downloading some information for the expert witness who's testifying, which is we can talk about tomorrow. Fascinating, there's apparently going to be, has been adduced into evidence or into testimony that the expert has had a lot of information that took
him
a year.
On the OnStar system. It took him 1 year to unlock it. It came out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
All we have is the first part of this, mm-hmm. you know, and we're trying to, as journalists, trying to take in this information and share it with you guys. But honestly, we got such a small piece of the puzzle mm-hmm. today. All we know really are some timestamps and,
right.
I mean, really, like we could speculate right now. But the it's on the truck that Alec was driving, we think, going to Almeda the night of the murders and then coming back. But, you know, they're not telling us that. They're just telling us timestamps and technical
mm-hmm.
stuff.
I think I can briefly sum this up to close us out because
okay.
I have a point I want to make about it. So what we heard at the end of, toward the end of the day before we abruptly adjourned was that it took the investigators a year to basically crack the code on how to get the data off of the infotainment system in Alex's Chevy Suburban SUV. They sent it to SLED. SLED couldn't do it. SLED sent it to the FBI. It took the FBI a year to get the info. And once they got the info, they had to go through a whole lot of... They basically had to reverse engineer the infotainment system and the computer within the infotainment system because, as the FBI agent testified, it was encrypted. He'd never seen anything like it. And he made the point it was not encrypted by anybody on the back end. It was encrypted by the manufacturer, General Motors.
Right.
The computer within the infotainment system was encrypted. So they had to reverse engineer the encryption and basically start from scratch on learning how to read and understand this computer data. And they did a whole bunch of testing. It took them a year to get it done. And all they were basically able to come up with is some very granular, you don't want to say inexact, but imperfect data. And the most reliable thing they could come up with is they could reliably say, based on the data, that they knew when the car shifted into out of park and back into park.
Right.
And based on the car shifting out of park and into park, they were able to determine on around a little after 9 p.m. on June 7th, 2021, Alex's car shifted out of park and was out of park for 16 minutes. 9:21 p.m., it's back in park for about 21 minutes or somewhere along in there. For about 21 minutes, it was in park, then it was out of park again, and then there were some very peculiar starts and stops. You know, the inference being he drove from, given the timestamps, he drove from Moselle to his mother's house, according to his alibi. He was there for 20 minutes, not 30 or 40, like he tried to apparently say to persuade his mother's caretaker to say. The timestamps on his car showing it starting up or shifting out of park at those times. But a lot to look into tomorrow with his, he seemed to drive straight there, but on the way back, a lot of peculiar,
little stops and starts and stops. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Now, my two big points on this.
Okay. Only two?
We go back. Let's think back to where we were in June of 2022, Ann.
Yeah. We
did a whole podcast.
Yep.
It's been a year. Why have there been no charges? Why we have all these financial charges, but why have there been no charges in this murder?
I knew he was going to go with this. Okay, yes.
What are the two big things we've learned so far in this case that explain the extraordinary delay? And that is, it took investigators 9 months to unlock Paul's phone, and it took them a year to unlock the data on Alex's SUV.
Good point.
And they made, at the very beginning of the trial, if you'll remember it, Creighton Waters got up in front of that jury and he held up a phone. He said, this right here, the data from this thing that we all carry in our hands, it's going to prove that he did what we say he did. He proved that he murdered his wife and son. And it's now coming into clearer scope what was taking so long. It's massively complex.
It was frustrating to everybody, and there was a lot of talk. So that I totally agree with you. I think they are doing a masterful job of explaining exactly why. And it wasn't AG's office or Sled holding him up. Was there anything else, Max? Was there something that you had to tell us? No, we're good. Okay, we're out. We're going to wrap this up now. We are going to have a lot more on all of this, especially this OnStar system. I'm thinking that's going to be coming up really soon. We don't know. It's up to the prosecution on their order. So we're going to bring the latest to you on day 14. Tomorrow is day 14 of this trial. I think we're going to have a lot of new information. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Good
for all of us
13.
Here at Unsolved South Carolina. We'll talk to you soon.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.